Why does Chloe Barnes fly from New York to Billings, Montana?
There are two storylines in this book. There is a romance that happens in modern day, and that's the love story between Chloe and my protagonist, Eli Singer. Eli is a rancher, and he's a poet in eastern Montana in the Missouri River Breaks. And he has published a couple of books of poetry, one of which has been represented by a New York agency. He is in New York to meet with his agent and happens to meet Chloe, who is in foreign sales. They meet, they strike up a friendship. She becomes intrigued by him, by his work, and by his background. And she travels to Montana to pursue the friendship and see where it leads.
Hello, and welcome to The Right Question, a radio program and podcast all about authors from the Western U.S. Our funding comes from contributors to Montana Public Radio and from Humanities Montana. I'm Cherie Newman, talking with Alan Jones today. He's the author of a new novel called Bloom of Bones. Well, let's hear you read a short passage which explains how Chloe and Eli met and what the attraction is about.
They'd met a little over a year ago. She'd been coming from the break room, dipping a tea bag, passing Leslie Gordon's office. An up-and-coming agent, gay as a parade, hungry as a cruising shark. He'd called out, "Chloe, sweetheart, you're from out west, right? Someone you have to meet, Eli. Chloe's in foreign rights. She'll be shopping your book around London here in a few months." Singer stood to meet her, only an inch or so taller than Chloe, and she's not especially tall. She noted the long torso and narrow hips. His hair had been inexpertly cut and still carried the indentation of the cowboy hat he'd left on the arm of his chair. Shaking hands, his palm was thick as a phone book, rough as the flipped side of a carpet. She said, "Sorry, what was your name again?" "A cowboy, 23 floors above Midtown." He winced slightly as they shook hands, and she noted a split thumbnail. He caught her look. "Missed my dally." As if anyone else in this entire building would know what that meant. But she did. And how had he recognized her? He had these blue, blue eyes. She admitted an interest. She said, "I can't wait to read your work." At Leslie's encouragement, and what was he doing representing a poet, for Christ's sake? She'd gone first to Singer's most recent book, 58 poems, gentle and self-effacing, but with odd, sporadic eruptions of brutality. He favored a short line, his verses tight as bread pressed into bricks, his own imagery. How could a guy who chewed skull come up with this? She began to see what Leslie saw. Leslie, who had a weakness for award winners. This guy could be another Wendell Berry, or maybe Berry meets Bukowski. In a poem about Sitting Bull's flight from General Miles, Singer described the old Indian finding a fossilized tooth in the eroded face of a clay bank. A granite canine red and ancient, glittering dark as coals. In fear and frustration, the Indian attacks the bluff, using the tooth to slash and stab at the clay, biting into fleshless skin. If Eli Singer wasn't famous, as she'd written him in an early email, it was only because he stood outside the circle jerk of gatekeeper academics. You'd like to think the poetry could stand on its own two legs, but it can't. The emails led to late-night phone calls, both of them drinking. "You know what I love about your work? How you know things. Nobody else knows anything. The suction slip of intestines from a deer, the hot wash of amniotic fluid from a heifer, the weighty obligations of an unfixed fence. Christ, Singer, if you'd gone to grad school, no way could you be writing this."
Chloe is obviously attracted to much more than just what Eli looks like. She's really dazzled by his poetry. And that's one thing that's really interesting about writers, how a specific person takes words and puts them in a specific order ends up being their magnetism to everybody else. What do you think about that?
You know, I think there's something there. I think in this book, Chloe is attracted to the contrast with New York. She's a city girl, and I think something about a Montana ranch and his context, where Eli comes from, I think is in some ways as attractive to her as the person himself. But I do think that that readers sometimes are attracted to or drawn to the personality behind the work as much as the work itself. In my own experience, I found that often they don't match. Over the course of my career, I've talked to a number of writers, and so often the writer's personality doesn't match the work. Maybe you've had the same experience in your work with The Right Question. You've interviewed any number of writers. Do you often find that the personality fits the work? Are writers what you expect when you meet them?
I try not to expect anything because I've learned that you can't. If you expect something, you're either going to be disappointed or amazed. I just wait for the person to show up. But yeah, it's a strange thing when you meet someone whose work you've admired. It's often discombobulating.
Mm-hmm. One of the virtues of fiction, of any writing, I guess, is that you, as the writer, you have the opportunity to revise and revisit. And so that gives you the chance to achieve a level of almost perfection in the work, hopefully, that you can come nowhere close to in your personal life. So you are striving for perfection on the page, but even while your personal life may be far from it.
You also work with editors and readers so that you have some of that feedback. So yes, you're in the process of perfecting the whole time that you're writing. Mm-hmm. And I just want to tell listeners that you are not only a writer, but a publisher, and you've been around this world in various incarnations mm-hmm. for quite a while.
My first real job out of college was working for the magazine Big Sky Journal in 94. I started out in magazine distribution. I had a fancy title, but I was basically typing in subscriptions. Within a year or so at that job, I then segued into being editor of the magazine and worked at that for about 5 years. And then from 2000 until 2006 or 7, I was a full-time freelance writer and sometime editor. And then I segued into book publishing. So then I worked as a book editor for the Lions Press, an imprint of Globe Pequot, and did that in various roles for a number of years before starting up my own small press, Bangtail Press. And last year, not quite a year ago, I went back to working as editor of the magazine Big Sky Journal.
And publishing books of your own.
That's right.
So you've been all through the circle. Let's talk about Chloe for a minute. She is one of the main characters of this book. Eli Singer, I would say, is the main character. But what is it about Chloe? What is it about her background that makes her attracted to someone who's obviously not very forthcoming with his own personal life?
Chloe's interest in Eli and her attraction to Montana, I think, are in large part a reflection of her idealized childhood in the Midwest. She grew up around horses. She grew up around cattle. And having lived in the city for so long now, she is trying to get back to her roots in some way, I think.
Mm. Well, when they get off the plane, they have to go for a long drive to get out to Eli's ranch. And for anybody who has been to this part of Montana that includes the town of Jordan and the location of Eli's ranch, it's pretty desolate. There's mm-hmm. not a lot out there. There are hills. There are kind of badlands and a lot of wind. And it's not quite what she thought it was. It's kind of like the writer who you meet and you're a little discombobulated by how they really are. She gets out there, and after these months of emails and phone calls with Eli, she's kind of having trouble adjusting to the reality.
I like that parallel between expectations and reality. Yeah, I think that's certainly the case. My family has property in Garfield County in eastern Montana, and we often bring people from back east or from this part of Montana to the place to our property to go hunting or to spend some time in the summer. And that's a reaction that I've become very familiar with. People who aren't who aren't familiar with Eastern Montana, who haven't spent much time there, are always, I think, a little taken aback by the isolation of it. And in my opinion, it's some of the most beautiful country in Montana, which is, of course, known for its beautiful country, but it's a different kind of beauty. It takes a certain eye to see it. If you're not familiar with it, if you don't expect to see it, then often you don't see the beauty. You see the isolation first.
And one of the things that happen right away after they arrive at Eli's ranch is he gets a phone call from the sheriff. Mm-hmm. So tell us what that's about.
So the engine of this novel, the narrative engine, if you will, is the discovery on Eli's ranch of a neighbor who had gone missing in the 1970s. This neighbor, Pete Fowler, just went missing. It was presumed that he ran out on his alimony obligations on his ex-wife and children. And after a brief search party, nothing more was made of it at the time. So Pete went missing. 30 years later, it turns out he had not run out on his obligations. He had been murdered, and his body erodes out of a hillside on Eli Singer's ranch. And the discovery of that body is coincidental with Chloe's visit to Eli's ranch. So while she is sparking up her relationship with Eli, it turns out that there is much more going on. She had come to Montana expecting a nice little ranch vacation, and she finds herself suddenly in the middle of a murder investigation.
And there's an exchange between Chloe and Eli about that investigation and that murder, and I'd like you to read that passage.
It starts out, this is Eli talking. Back in 79, one of our neighbors went missing. Everybody figured he just kind of skipped out on alimony. Pete was such a massive son of a bitch, would have been typical. But now they're saying this is likely him, dental records and whatnot. He watched her try to do the math. I was 12. Huh. They got a chunk of my ground all roped off with that police tape. So do they know who killed him? This guy, Pete. Biggest liar in the world. My old stepdad used to say Pete would rather climb a tree and tell a lie than stand on the ground and tell the truth. Guy was despised pretty much up and down the county. Could have been about anybody. So they don't know who killed him. I don't guess. Is that what the sheriff wants to talk about? What I'd want to talk about if I was him? She flashed back to the grocery store, to the old couple's shunning of Singer. People think you might have had something to do with it? He tongued at his chew, glanced away. We moved here when I was 12. You knew that, right? I didn't, no. I've lived here most of my life, but I'm still from Billings. I'm not from here. That's the crux of it. Pete Fowler, son of a bitch that he was a homegrown kind of son of a bitch. They'll want to think I had something to do with it, even if I didn't. So did you? He drifted away. Hey, what now? Have something to do with it? Of course not. Hell no.
You're listening to The Right Question. I'm Cherie Newman talking with Alan Morris Jones about his novel Bloom of Bones. If you just joined us, you can hear what you missed online at mtpr.org. You can listen from our blog or sign up for our podcast. And you can find us on Facebook and Twitter. There are several poems in this novel, written, obviously, by you.
Yes.
Which came first, the poems or the novel?
That's a good question. There were one or two poems, one poem in particular that I wrote first. And then as the novel shaped itself, I found a reason to include the poem. But for the most part, I wrote the poems to fit the narrative. I wanted the poems to reinforce the themes of the book, to draw the reader's attention to certain aspects of the ongoing narrative. So the poems are interspersed throughout the book, ostensibly written by Singer, and they are meant to provide glimpses into Singer's psyche, I suppose. So this is what has preoccupied him over the years, as seen in his poetry, in his work. Interesting side note, a friend of mine, William Kittredge, kindly provided a blurb for the book. I've known Bill for some years. We worked together on the short story anthology I've published him at Big Sky Journal. And so I sent him the book and asked if he liked it. Would you be so kind as to provide a supporting blurb? He did. And in conversation about the book, one of the first things he asked was, and I'm about to do a very bad Bill Kittredge impersonation. He said, did you write all those poems? And I said, yeah, Bill, I wrote those poems. Yeah, I figured, Bill said. And I read them, I figured, yeah, Jones finally figured out a way to get his poetry published. Which is not far from the truth.
Well, two of those poems, some people say coyote and some people say coyote. I say coyote. So two of the poems are titled The Coyote Part One, and that's near the beginning of the book. And then there's The Coyote Part Two, which is near the end. Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you would mind reading those, and then I want to talk about how they fit into the narrative.
The Coyote Part One. He slipped through burnt timber, thick fur damp under falling snow, browsing the day's odors, tender nose tilted to the breeze, then hesitated, ears swiveling towards something amiss. Me. 100 clumsy and heavy boots, musing on the miracle of the moment, how I was alive here among the charred branches under the falling snow. He scratched an ear, licked at a paw, tasted the miles traveled since dawn. He had been here forever, and will be here forever, in the new snow falling gently on black bark. Amen.
So in that poem, the coyote is alive and well and foraging on the land.
And something of a miracle, you know, if you pay attention to what goes on in a typical ranch, you know, not only the working aspects of the ranch, but everything else, the wildlife, the deer, the coyotes, the elk. During the course of a day, I think everyone has these moments of pause where you stop and consider just how extraordinary it is to be in this particular place at this particular time. And I think that poem addresses some of that. But if you are also a rancher, particularly a sheep rancher, I think if you're faced with managing your livestock, often you shoot coyotes, which is where the second poem comes in. The Coyote Part Two. Careful of the blood, I draped him across a sheet of plywood, unzipped him belly to chin, sliced the pelt away until his lipless skull grinned up, sharing the oldest joke in the world. Either everything is forgivable, I thought, or nothing is.
So I wonder if we can talk about the contrast between those two poems without giving the whole story away.
The first chapter of the book is a scene wherein Eli and his stepfather, Buddy Singer, are burying Pete Fowler. So we know that immediately coming out of the gate that this story will lead to this particular scene. I intended the engine of the book to be the question surrounding this incident. So the reader is meant to have a measure of curiosity about how the story eventually manages to get back to this scene. So we know coming out of the gate that Eli, despite his denials, is involved in some way with this murder. And we know that he is lying, specifically lying to Chloe throughout the narrative. As their affections grow, he is not only faced with dealing with the public perception of his own role in the disappearance, but he's faced with reconciling his affection for and trust with Chloe, with his continuing deception. He's stuck between a rock and a hard place in some ways in that regard. Those two poems, Coyote Part 1, Coyote Part 2, are somewhat meant to mirror the narrative arc of the novel. So as Eli comes to reveal more and more about his past in the context of Chloe, then he moves from one place to another narratively. And those poems hopefully reflect that narrative movement.
Throughout the book, Eli's part is written in first person, mm-hmm. and Chloe's part is written in third. So we're looking at Chloe interact with Eli, mm-hmm. and we're hearing Eli's story. And at times, it's almost metafiction.
Even though there is a murder at the heart of the book, and even though there is the compelling question is a murder, the circumstances of the murder, it falls into, you know, fairly traditional genre. It's Montana noir. It's a murder mystery. I still think of the book primarily as a character-driven narrative. As a writer, I wanted to explore who these people were and show their development through the course of the novel. And it was easier to do that and more effective, I think, to approach Eli's part of the book in first person, to explore his story directly through his eyes, and then to do Chloe's story in third person. I'm not sure, frankly, where that came from. I suspect it has to do with my own comfort level. As a male writer, it's easier to write male writers from a first-person point of view. It maybe felt a little presumptuous to appropriate a female character in the first person. If you're Jim Harrison, you can do that with Dalva. I'm not sure that I'm enough of a writer to do that with Chloe. But the end result of it, going back and forth, is that I think nicely you end up seeing more of the characters from each point of view. You see Chloe from Singer's first-person point of view, and you get to see Singer from a third-person, limited, omniscient point of view through Chloe's eyes. So I think going back and forth between them, you get to see a bit more of the characters than you might have otherwise.
When he was thinking about his time in the military, Eli thinks, quote, "Love and hate are the persistent irreducibles of our species." Well, what does he mean by that?
That line comes in the middle of his love affair with Chloe, the developing love affair. And he is reminiscing back on a scene from his war years during Desert Storm. So here's, on the one hand, here is war. On the other hand, here is his developing love for Chloe. He has seen some awful things in his life, and he has seen some very nice things. So I think he's discussing the essential polarity of the human condition, maybe, to put a very fancy face on it. Love and hate, war and love, love and death, creation and destruction, yin-yang.
What do you want people to know about this, or what do you want them to know about why you wrote this book? Is it was just a story that was burning inside you and had to come out?
Yes and no. I mean, the story, I think, has come over the years. I've been living with this story for some time. I wrote the first draft over 12 years ago and put it away. Revised it a couple of years later. You know, the first draft took about a year to write. I put it away. I revisited it a few years later, revised it again. And then about a year and a half ago, I looked at it a third time for a major revision and thought, you know, there is indeed something here. This is publishable. I think people might enjoy reading this. And that was when I started shopping it around for a publisher. The things that are important to me about the story, I think, most of all, I wanted to create a compelling, important diversion. I wanted to create a literary novel that explored character, that explored place in interesting ways. But I wanted to combine that with the aspects of mainstream genre fiction that allow readers to be absorbed by a book and diverted by a book. What is it about the newest Lee Child or Harlan Coben novel that really resonates with people that make us eat those books up like candy? There is a compelling question that serves as the engine of the book, and you are made as the reader to find out what happens. You are compelled. You want to stay up at night and finish the book at all costs. And many of those books don't do very much in terms of, they don't stick with you. They don't create characters that are especially memorable. They don't create human situations that resonate, that stay with you. But they do that one thing very well, which is make you want to find out what happens. As an exercise, as a writer, I wanted to combine those two. I wanted to create a compelling story, a compelling question. I wanted to give the reader that urge to find out what happens. But I wanted to do it within the framework of what we think of as a more traditional literary novel, which is character-driven exposition, an interesting take on the scene, et cetera, all the things that we think about when we think about literary fiction.
Well, I had to read, stay up late, find out what happened.
That's very good to hear. Thank you.
Something I've been thinking about for a while, because I was looking at my bookshelf and mostly Western writers, obviously, and it was just kind of going through the plots in my mind, and I thought, is Western literature really as dark as it looks on my bookshelf? I mean, there are so many dysfunctional families. The life is so hard. There's so much poverty. Do you think that's our theme?
That's a very good question as well. There is something to that. I would hesitate to make a sweeping generalization in that regard. There are some beautiful bright spots. Thinking about my own favorite books, there's James Galvin's The Meadow, which is not dark in that particular way, although it has aspects of that. I mentioned Bill Kittredge earlier. His novel The Willow Field is a beautiful book that isn't particularly dark. But I do think there are certainly themes that focus on that. I had a pet theory for some time that a lot of the darkness in Western literature comes from the realization among writers, they'd get halfway through their books and realize that there was no way they were ever going to make a living at this. So that makes you pretty depressed when you think about it. So I think that showed up in the work a little bit.
Alan Morris Jones lives in Bozeman, Montana. Look for more information about him and his books and sign up for our podcast. It's all at mtpr.org. Also at the blog, children's book reviews, poetry, and links to our Facebook and Twitter pages. Many thanks to Humanities Montana for supporting The Right Question since 2008. And thanks to you for listening and for your financial contribution. I'm Cherie Newman, wishing you piles of fascinating books and lots of questions.
The Right Question is produced by Cherie Newman, Beth Ann Austin, studio engineer. You'll find links to our podcast and Facebook and Twitter pages at mtpr.org.